Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. And we are back. First things first, Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to 2018. I had a great holiday, but I've definitely been itching to get back to the show. As most of you know, at the end of last year, we held a listener giveaway to celebrate hitting one of our biggest milestones to date, 1 million plays of this podcast. Thanks to everyone who entered. We sent out an email to entrants a few days ago, so please be on the lookout for that. If you haven't heard from us yet, just reach out to us at team@twimmelai.com so that we can get you your swag. Next up, the details for our January meetup are set. Next Tuesday, January 16th, we'll be joined by veteran Twimmel guest and Microsoft researcher Timnit Gebru. Timnit joined us just a few weeks ago to discuss her recently released and much acclaimed paper, Using Deep Learning and Google Street View to Estimate the Demographic Makeup of Neighborhoods Across the United States. And I'm excited that she'll be joining us to discuss her paper and the pipeline she used to identify 22 million cars in 50 million Google Street View images. I'm anticipating a very lively discussion segment as well, in which we'll be exploring your AI resolutions and predictions for 2018. For links to the paper, or to register for the meetup, or just to check out previous meetups, visit twimmelai.com/meetup. Finally, a bit about today's show. I'm joined by David Venturelli, Science Operations Manager and Quantum Computing Team Lead for the University's Space Research Association's Institute for Advanced Computer Science at NASA Ames. David joined me backstage at the NYU Future Labs AI Summit a while back to give me some insight into a topic that I've been curious about for some time now, quantum computing. We kick off our discussion with a review of the core ideas behind quantum computing, including what it is, how it's applied, and the ways it relates to computing as we know it today. We then discuss the practical state of quantum computers and what their capabilities are, as well as the kinds of things you can do with them. And of course, we explore the intersection between AI and quantum computing, how quantum computing may one day accelerate machine learning, and how interested listeners like you can get started down the quantum computing rabbit hole. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am here at the NYU Skirball Center backstage, just as we're finishing up the NYU Future Labs AI Summit. And I have the pleasure of being seated with David Venturelli, who's the Science Operations Manager for the Research Institute for Advanced Computer Science at NASA Ames. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you on the show. And I am really looking forward to this conversation because you are doing a ton of work in an area that I know very little about, but keep hearing a lot about, and that is quantum computing. So before we get into me peppering you with questions, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into quantum compute yourself?
Yes. So I'm a physicist. I'm a theoretical physicist, and I did study quantum mechanics like every physicist does. Back when I was a PhD student in 2008-7, there was hype on inside the physics community about quantum computing, but it's nothing like what we have today. What I did study quantum information science, did study nanotechnology, and of course, I have seen in front of me unfolding the opportunities of actually not only validating the theories on pen and paper, but now experimenting with real-world quantum machines. Mm-hmm. So I joined a quantum artificial intelligence laboratory in 2012, as one of the founding members. NASA, Google, and USRA, University Space Research Association, decided to create this group to investigate the near-term impact of quantum computing for computational problems of national interest. And that was, you know, what I've been doing in the last 5 years. We managed projects in collaboration with government, academia, and with, of course, the principal stakeholders, the private sectors as well, to understand really if in the next 5 to 10 years there could be an acceleration of computing because of quantum technologies.
Great. I guess the place to start is on quantum technologies and quantum computing. Like, I imagine that it is something that many in the audience have heard of, but don't fully understand, you know, not just what the big ideas are, but what are the foundational ideas upon which it's built. And I'm hoping maybe you can walk us through some of that.
Yes. The idea comes from the 80s when one of the gods of physics, Richard Feynman, made the observation at a conference, pretty casual observation, that if we were able to create a computer which worked with the laws of quantum physics, then simulating quantum systems would not be very difficult. While today it's very, very difficult to do that. We need supercomputers and blah, blah, blah. So this observation changed the world because the idea of processing information with the fundamental laws of nature as APIs, as elementary building block of the algorithms, really got every physicist excited. Some early discoveries on the fact that the mathematics of quantum mechanics is fundamentally more powerful than the mathematics we employ when we process information in standard digital computers, really got everyone excited.
Can you give us some examples of that?
Yes. So people have discovered in 96 that you can search a database, an unstructured database, where basically all the information is not arranged by any sorting. Normally, to search that such database, you do not have any smart way to do it because you just have to randomly make queries. And if you're unlucky, you will find what you're looking for as the last attempt of your query. And that means that the problem has a linear complexity, meaning that if you have n items, you need n trials to get to the item you want in the worst case scenario. Now, if you had the quantum database and the ability of doing quantum queries and you exploit all these effects of superposition, interference, entanglement, you are able to find the item you want in a square root of the number of items. So this means that instead of, for example, 100 queries, you need only 10. Mm-hmm. And this quadratic speedup is a very interesting phenomenon, which shows by itself that quantum computing is more powerful than classical computing because there's no way you can beat this without quantum mechanics. But what people is really after is exponential speedup. So the opportunity to devise algorithmical strategies that are able to accelerate exponentially problems. There are some examples in cryptography, in chemistry, where we know how to exponentially bypass the bottlenecks of computation so that problems that could be solved today in billions of years, they would be solved by a quantum computer in seconds. But this is not the case for a lot of things that we want to solve. And we are investigating, and it's so difficult to investigate these algorithms without having a quantum computer, that in some sense, we want to build quantum computers to understand whether it was worth to build them in the first place.
So is it fair then to say, what I took away from that is that quantum computers isn't the idea of kind of going piece by piece and replacing the various components on a current system board with, you know, quantum versions. It's not like, you know, shrinking down the physics is. It is a fundamental new way of thinking about compute that's built around the...
It's a new paradigm. It's not incremental improvement. It's really a different fundamental way to process information. Of course, quantum effects are already very well taken care of by the silicon industry in integrated circuitry already, but today they kind of bother you. You're because you want to shrink things, you want to make them more faster. Now, what we're talking about is assigning a functional role to the quantum effect, and actually assigning logical states and variables to quantum states, mm-hmm. and then very finely, very delicately orchestrate their quantum dynamics so that we do mathematical operations on our logical assignments. Mm-hmm. And this is a new paradigm. It is operating on probability distributions, which are weird because they're not over real numbers, they're over complex numbers. So there are imaginary units involved. And mm-hmm. it's very interesting mathematically. And funny enough, for the listener of this show, you don't really need to know physics to become a quantum algorithm person. Okay. It's actually linear algebra. So as long as you accept why quantum mechanics works, mm-hmm. you can study it in an afternoon. Well, if you have the mathematical background, you can study it fast. And just, you don't know why it works. It doesn't matter. But you can start writing algorithms mm-hmm. because it's just, you know, matrix multiplications and things like that.
What are some of the... You kind of rattled off some quantum primitives that, you know, upon which this math and these computers are built. Can you kind of give us the next level of detail into, you know, some of the most important ones?
Of course. The main paradigm which is explored today is to use binary variables, so bits, basically, mm-hmm. but generalized in the quantum world. So the idea of using quantum bits or qubits. Mm-hmm. So you do identify a physical system. It could be a superconductor, a circuit, or it could be an atom, it could be an electron, it could be a photon, anything. Anything which is sufficiently small, cold, protected from the external environment, follows the laws of quantum physics. Mm-hmm. Even cats in boxes, apparently. So as long as you're able to find that, then you look at the states of the system and then you identify what is you call zero and what you call one. For example, it could be...
Aren't there more states in a quantum system?
Yes, but you choose two of them.
Oh, really?
Okay. So you say, okay, this electron can have spin up or spin down, for those that know physics. Mm-hmm. Or this photon can have polarization in one way or in another. This superconductor can have a clockwise current or a counterclockwise mm-hmm. current. And then you look at how you can act on the system. Mm-hmm. So similarly, as you do in chemistry, if the system is quantum, you can manipulate their state. Like in chemistry, you can do chemistry reaction. But this time you need to be very controlled. So if it is an atom, you need to shine a laser. If it is a circuit, you need to apply a magnetic field mm-hmm. and all these kind of things. And when you do that, you know how your state will change. The fun fact is that it is totally true in quantum mechanics that you can have a state which is not zero, not one. It's kind of a superposition of the two mm-hmm. and is represented by this abstract vector in a complex number subspace where you represent zero and one at the same time. Now, when you look at it, it will be zero or it will be one with some probability. But if you don't look at it, then it's both. And you can operate on it like if it is both until you look at it. Mm-hmm. So the algorithm, the job of the programmer is to figure out a way to operate on this ensemble of qubits in such a way to orchestrate the probability at the end to be the solution of the problem you want to solve. Mm-hmm. But that's a complex job because, you know, if you have n qubits, what you are really describing is a state which has an exponential number of degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. So, and you need to basically describe it with 2 to the power of n complex numbers. And there's no way you can simulate this mm-hmm. in a machine. You need a quantum computer to experiment most of the time.
So it sounds like one of the fundamental realities of quantum computing is this chicken and an egg problem. Like how do we get beyond that?
Yes, you're totally right. We are getting beyond that. We decided, I don't know, the chicken or the egg, what we decided, but we decided that it's worth it's worth to do it, and we're starting. There are companies, IBM, Rigetti, Google, Intel, they're all building chips, mm-hmm. and they're making them available to the research community, and people are trying to use them mm-hmm. In the short term to learn about quantum mechanics, to validate the theories that on pen and paper have been devised in the last 30 years. Yeah. So now we are really using quantum computers as tools for improving our knowledge of quantum information processing.
Yeah, so IBM, Intel, some of these companies that you've mentioned have been talking about this forever, like in kind of research mode. I think the thing that really caught my attention recently was, I think it was their Build conference, one of the Microsoft's recent technical conferences. There was, I think it was a keynote, like their main announcement, Satya Nadella came out and had some researchers, and they kind of, you know, brought out this, I'm not even sure what it was. It looked like a GPU, to be honest. They brought out this board that was their first attempt at a quantum computer or something. You tell me what exactly that was and what's its significance.
Yeah, no, Microsoft as well as IBM, as you said, like everyone had some quantum computing expertise since the beginning of time, meaning since when the field has as a name, and for good reasons. I mean, good physicists kept an eye on the idea since the beginning, and and these companies hired very good people. Now, what changed now is that people are confident that we can achieve great results very fast. Great results in terms of science, not necessarily on applications yet, because and Microsoft, for example, it's interesting because they decided to, they always had a very good group on architectures and quantum operative systems and quantum compilation methods. But now they decided to expand and go experimental as well. Their approach is long term. They want to do a topological quantum computing, which is a complicated mathematical theory, which is allowing this type of computer to be automatically protected against the noise of the external world. So it would be amazing if it ever works. However, as far as we know, nobody has even ever even created a single qubit. So everyone is really looking at what they are thinking of doing, because even the announcement of a single qubit would be interesting.
So let me just hit pause on that. So the qubit is the fundamental unit of this computer. It's the bit in contemporary computing. And we've not produced one yet.
No. In the approach that Microsoft wants, they didn't. Now, to give you a sense, so IBM has 16 qubits operational, allowing researchers to use them.
Google, and when you say 16 qubits, does that mean
16 bits?
Just 16 bits, not 16, an array of 16.
No. You can not even solve a Sudoku with that. It's nothing. Okay. Google has 9, but 22 under testing, 49 announced. Then Rigetti has about 8. Now, D-Wave has 2,000. You say, oh my God, D-Wave is so far ahead.
Who's D-Wave?
D-Wave is a Canadian company which kind of schooled the world in the fact that you can try to build a quantum computer.
Okay.
And they did before everyone. And that's even why my group exists, because Google decided to buy one of these machines.
Okay. And a then D-Wave machine? One of the D-Wave machines?
Yes.
Okay.
And to host it at NASA, and that we operated.
And is this analogous to, you know, mainframe computers where it takes an entire
It's a huge black box which operates...
For 40 bits?
It's 2,000. It's 2,000 bits. But 2,000, there's a catch there. So first of all, this is a huge machine. It operates with a cryogenics temperature. So at 13 millikelvin, we're talking about less... than the temperature of space. It requires a vacuum, it requires a helium. It's a complex machine, but it implements one strategy of computation, which is quite unknown, meaning that not so well studied, which is called quantum annealing, which does not have all the requirements of the other kind of computation. But at the same time, it's unclear the power of it. So they decided indeed to create it to experiment. And NASA and Google and USRA decided to support the project. And then after this, Lockheed Martin bought a machine, Los Alamos bought a machine. So now they're doing quite well.
How much does one of these machines cost?
Street price is from 10 million to 15 million.
I don't want to
ask them for
is.
The latest quote. I don't know. But it's actually, I want to advertise in this show, everyone can use this machine. USRA has a program, a collaboration program, for which 20% of the machine time can be outsourced to any researcher which is submitting a proposal. It's just a 5 pages proposal. So the website where to find it is www.usra.edu/quantum/RFP, request for proposal. Okay. But so USRA Quantum D-Wave, if you Google it, people can find.
And we'll
and we had about 80 people, 80 groups, 80 research groups from all kinds of universities around the world, which are running on the machine, or they propose. Some of them are running, some not yet, but it's a very successful program.
Wow. And is all of the research that's happening on this machine about how to build more machines like it, or are people doing, you know, how far are we in terms of doing things with it? Can we add 1+1 yet with this machine?
Or? Yeah, no, we can do more than that, but not much more than that. No, you're totally right. Let's say 90% of the really invested research is of fundamental nature. We need to improve our understanding, get a different mindset, and figuring out how to improve these machines themselves. At the same time, I say that programming this kind of machines, using this kind of machines, can often lead to new ideas in classical computing, because you need to change the mindset to frame the problem in a different way in order to be attacked by the quantum computers. So there are a lot of anecdotes of people coming up with a quantum algorithm that is beating every possible classical algorithm that was created before. And then the classical guys came back and say, wait a second,
I can
improve my algorithm. And then they improved it and they beaten the quantum again and so on.
Any examples that come to mind?
Yeah, but it's a very nerdy example. there's a recent result on QAOA, which is baptized by us the quantum alternating operator ansatz algorithm.
Okay.
Which is shown to basically have a particular scaling, which seemed to be better to what was before known on a problem which E3 Lin, it's basically connected to satisfiability. But the point is like a very specific problem. It seemed that this algorithm was beating it, and then the classical computer scientist came back and they improved their own algorithm. Mm-hmm. So this is the latest example. In general, I mean, it's fun quantum computing because there's so much room for improvement in our understanding that it's really fun. For instance, chemistry. Mm-hmm. Chemistry is the holy grail of quantum computing because we can simulate molecules much faster. And people were writing on the back of the envelope calculations 7 years ago, 6-7 years ago on how fast a quantum computer would solve, for example, the molecular ground state of interesting molecules, such as ferredoxine, I remember, which is a fertilizer. I mean, it's interesting. And people were trying to calculate it and saying, oh, okay, it would still take some billions of years, okay? It's not very interesting because, okay, with a classical computer, it's impossible. It would take trillions of years. Quantum computer would take billions. Okay, it's not very very worth doing it. But then, you know, new postdocs look at the problem and say, no, wait a second, it's not scaling as n to the power of 11. It's scaling as n to the power of 9 because I can do these mathematical tricks. Okay. And then new postdocs and PhD students look at the problem and say, wait a second, why don't I do this transformation before and I represent the problem with Gaussian waves instead, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then they put it down to a few years. Say, well, it's still, not very interesting. Mm-hmm. But then in a matter of like, I don't know, a few months, other groups improved, and now we're talking seconds.
Wow.
So on that particular project,
from trillions of
on
years
a specific
to
molecule that people investigated, the initial estimates based on quantum mechanics understanding were so improvable that they brought down n to the power of 11 to n to the power of 3 and make the things much more tractable.
And so now what are the requirements of implementing this algorithm that they've designed in terms of a quantum computer? Does our D-Wave 2000 bit thing get us anywhere near that, or?
No, so D-Wave, as I was mentioning before, they can attack only some specific algorithms, combinatorial optimization with a specific method and it's unclear what the performance of this machine can be. We are investigating them. Early results is that it's comparable with the Intel chips on these small problems. Now, we would like to investigate them on large problems so that we really could see the difference, because now we're still talking about problems you can solve in seconds, so it's not really clear the overhead, how much it counts, and blah, blah, blah. But this this is interesting for D-Wave because, again, every machine they release is a little bit more powerful than the previous one, also on a qualitative level. They give you more knobs, they give you more physical effects to experiment with. So that's interesting. But to run the algorithms for chemistry, for database search that I discussed, or cryptography, you need the computers such as the ones which are created by now by IBM, Google, which right now are at this 9-qubit, 16-qubit stage, because they're much more difficult to build, because they give you much more control. And they're called the universal digital quantum computers, as opposed to the D-Wave, which is an analog quantum annealer. So it's a little bit different flavor. So this,
so the, if I could paraphrase, the architecture of the this D-Wave computer is limited in some ways, so that it can only you can only implement these quantum annealing algorithms, and that's a sounds like a smallish subset. Actually, we don't really know
exactly. We don't know
what
but
types of algorithms will.
Yes, they're run easier on this. To build the computers, but much more limited in their algorithmical encoding. To give you an idea, with 2,000 qubits, we can more or less solve problems of that you can, classical problems you can encode in 50 bits, roughly. Okay, it could be 60, sometimes 100. I mean, it depends on the compilation.
And is that like, is
it's
that 2,000 bits or the 50 bits, is this the entire state of the computer? Like include, like a traditional computer has, you know, there's state in the CPU, there are registers, there's all of these things.
Yeah, so yes
and
no.
Is that all different in the quantum
world? Yes and no. Let's say, no. Your question is on point. The end-to-end solvers will be hybrid, you know, system which have a classical coprocessor, quantum processor. So after all, you can decompose your problem, pre-process it, divide it in chunks so that the quantum computer just solves the combinatorial aspect of it and the other does something in parallel. So we're way behind in figuring out what's the best way to solve a full problem. We are experimenting right now on very specific special purpose problems. And in that case, yes, we can use only this little memory. Okay. But it's improving at every stage, okay? So the next generation machine probably will be much better than the previous one.
And how many bits do we need to get to on the universal side to be useful?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it depends on the approach. For example, the Microsoft approach, it could be a few hundred for the Microsoft approach, but they don't even have one. But for the other approaches, like the ones which are superconducting, we likely need almost a million.
Oh, wow.
Almost. I mean,
and we're at 9.
Yes. I mean, the scalability is there. What is more difficult is the error correction. The error correction, we have very good theories, but we need to get the fidelity of the operations to a certain level of precision. But there's no fundamental reason why we shouldn't be able to do that with good engineering. You need to understand that the quantum engineer job is a new job. I mean, everyone which worked on this is a physicist, and physicists do not know how to, you know, build products. So, I mean, and so now engineers are getting into this game. So I believe that we will have very interesting machines soon. And there's not only the big players, there are startups which come out, spun off of universities. For example, IonQ out of Maryland is doing an amazing job with the ion trap.
Ion cube?
Ion Q.
Okay.
They're trapping atoms with lasers and manipulating them. They're very, very, very good at this. There's a University of Bristol group, in the UK, which has some stealth operation on fully photonic computers. So basically a lot of lasers. Okay. So I believe in the landscape 1 year from now will be already different significantly from the landscape of today.
Wow.
And that's fun.
So we haven't even gotten to AI yet. Like, what's the intersection between, you're at the quantum AI lab, what's the intersection between quantum computing and AI?
That's a very, very good question. So our name is might be a little misleading. We have a...
Is it quantum slash AI?
No. It's a quantum AI. It's okay. A quantum AI. First of all, AI is not only machine learning. There's a lot of methods that are considered AI since even before the hype on machine learning took off. So we do a lot of optimization. It's part of the AI. We do a lot of planning and scheduling, okay. which is one of my personal work, where we actually have to take decisions of how robots operate on distant planets. Okay, how to take the robust decisions. Mm-hmm. That's the problem that you need to solve by model-based algorithmics. So that's why there's an AI in our name, because we do pay particular attention to problems where there's not good solution yet, and we need expert artificial systems to solve them. But the intersection of quantum computing and AI is interesting, even beyond what we do in the quantum artificial intelligence laboratory. The intersection could be on a technical standpoint, on machine learning, there are approaches which are being investigated. This is a very new field, so we're right. talking about only a few years of research, where you can apply some algorithms of quantum computing to gain polynomial speedups on certain aspects, for example, training the neural networks. There are approaches where you can use quantum correlations to implement quantum neural networks. Okay, I mean, this requires a huge number of qubits, of course, but people are actually looking at this kind of thing. And these quantum neural networks might be very good at learning mm-hmm. quantum problems. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a little bit self-referential, but but that's another approach that is being investigated. Mm-hmm. And I must say, there's an intersection on the other point of the arrows. That there's a lot that AI can do for quantum computing.
Okay.
So the payoff will come afterwards. Quantum computing will pay back in 10 years or something. But for now...
What are some of those ideas, do you think?
Even compiling a problem into a quantum computer is a big problem. And you need
kind of
methods.
Optimization on steroids.
Calibrating a quantum computer is also a pain in, okay? I mean, it's crazy. And again, laboratories are training neural networks, and they are employing heavy heuristics to be able to do that. So there is an opportunity on both ends to imagine what quantum computing can do for AI and how to employ AI to enable quantum computing.
Wow. We're getting to the end of our time, but is there a kind of a canonical reference or a place that people can start if they want to learn more about quantum AI, or not quantum AI, but quantum computing?
Yes, there are a lot of tutorials which have been published over the years.
Not like build your own qubits.
No, it's not.
With a 3D printer, maybe?
It's really not that inaccessible as it was a few years ago.
Okay.
So my suggestion is to look for the reviews and the lecture notes of the most prominent professors in the field. I suggest to look at, for example, John Preskill's lecture notes at Caltech. That's a good start. There's another very very skilled evangelizers of quantum computing is Scott Aronson. He has a fantastic blog, which is very followed, where he discusses a lot of aspects of quantum computing. So I'm sure that if the listener to this show are motivated, they will find their way. And of course, please feel free to contact me. My email is David with an E at the end, .venturelli@nasa.gov.
Okay, great. Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time out to chat with us. I learned a ton, but there is so much more to learn about this. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening and for your continued feedback and support. Thanks to you, this podcast finished the year as a top 40 technology podcast on Apple Podcasts. My producer says that one of his goals this year is to crack the top 10. And to do that, we need you to head over to your podcast app, rate the show, hopefully we've earned 5 stars, leave us a glowing review, and share it with your friends, family, coworkers, the barista at Starbucks, your Uber driver, everyone. Every review, rating, and share goes a long way, so thanks so much in advance. As you know, I love to meet Twilma listeners. This week, I'll be at the CES show in Las Vegas, so if you're in the area and would like to meet up, ping me at @SamCharrington on Twitter. Last, but certainly not least, for more information on David or any of the topics covered in this episode, head on over to twimlai.com/talk/93. Of course, we'd be delighted to hear from you either via a comment on the show notes page or via Twitter at @twimlai. Thanks once again for listening, and catch you next time.